I was at work when the two planes hit the towers yesterday. My office, Two World Financial Center, was on the 24th floor and faced the towers from across the street. I was at my desk when the first plane hit. We shook a bit in our seats, but we didn't know what had happened. I ran to the window and looked down, and I thought it was a car bomb like in 1993. I saw a parking lot that had a variety of things on fire. People started screaming about the tower. This was about 45 seconds after impact. I ran to the other side of my office and saw fire raining down. Parts of the building were falling and on fire along with paper and other things. We had to look way up because the plane hit in the higher floors. The impact hole was huge. It looked like 10 stories were burning. The fire seemed to crawl around the tower. The winds were so high it caused the smoke to spin in a large swirl. It's hard to describe how the building looked from my angle. You just couldn't believe what you were seeing. At that point, we didn't know what had happened. After the crash was reported by the news, our phones started ringing. Wives, husbands, and friends asking, "Hey, did you see what happened?" I was walking around the desk of my office when the other plane hit. It felt like an earthquake. I stumbled with the hit. People started yelling. One man in my office saw the plane go in and screamed that it was another plane. We ran again to the window. This time it was much lower in the tower. It seemed worse than the first because it was so much closer to my office. People on the street could feel the fireball. My manager started yelling, "Everybody get out! Everybody get out now!" I grabbed my bag, my Palm Pilot, and my juice, and I headed for the stairs. 24 floors isn't that bad, but they were full of people. Most were very upset and panicky. We got to the Winter Garden lobby and headed out to South End Street, parallel to the river. I walked out and just saw a crowd staring up at the burning towers. It was surreal. This is the only word that can be used to amply describe the scene. I stood there for a minute and watched the fire climb up, down, and around the towers. I heard sudden cries from the crowd and looked up and saw people falling, jumping to their deaths. I wish I could say there was only one. It got worse as the fire spread. I moved next to the marina and watched a bit more. Trying to call anyone proved almost impossible. I left messages for my immediate family and lent my phone to two men to call their wives. I then started walking up West Side Highway with the rest of the refugees, and I mean refugees. I then came upon a guy with a telescope aimed at one of the towers. The picture I saw, I will never forget. At about the 60 to 70th floors, people were hanging out windows, trying to get air. Literally holding on to the side of the building, waving t-shirts, trying to get someone's attention. I couldn't watch any longer. I kept walking, and about 10 minutes later, I was about a half a mile away and was talking with someone. We heard this sound. It can only be described as a thundering crack. That's the best I can do. I then saw what I thought was just a chunk of the World Trade Center, but it was actually the whole tower. I said, "It wasn't. It can't be." I couldn't believe it. With the first collapse, people started running from the wall of smoke, dust, and ash that erupted. I stopped by a car on the side of the road with about 15 other people. That's when I learned about the Pentagon and the hijackings. A little while later, as I continued the walk home, I heard that crack again. I ran to the corner to catch the second plume of smoke and debris from the second tower collapsing. I stood there for a while in utter shock and disbelief, and then I took the long walk home. The city was closed. The streets were crowded with people and emergency vehicles, and that was it. It was so quiet. People walking home everywhere, and yet it was so quiet. The silence was deafening. You know, a terrorist's greatest weapon, it's not a gun, it's not a hand grenade, it's not a guillotine or a machete, it's not a bomb, it's not even an airplane. A terrorist's greatest weapon is fear.
the violence that they enact is not their ultimate goal. Their ultimate goal is what happens after, to captivate us, to captivate people in fear, to control them with fear. Tore Bjørgo, who is a professor and a researcher of extremism and terrorism at the University of Oslo, which is in Norway, wrote this about terrorism. He said, "Terrorism is the premeditated use of violence in order to achieve a psychological effect of fear. The violence is just the means to the end. The goal is fear. They want to control us with fear." Notice the last thing, that the psychological effect is centered on people other than the immediate targets. Fernando Reynares, an advisor to the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperative, noted a couple different traits of terrorism. First, it's an act of violence used to produce widespread emotional reactions such as fear and anxiety. The violence is used to produce the emotional reaction. Why? To influence attitudes and behaviors. Terrorists kill not to kill. That's just an added bonus. They kill to captivate us with fear, so they can control us with fear. He then added that violence conveys messages and threats in order to communicate and to gain control. Fear is the goal. Control through fear is the goal. Think about this, the death toll from the World Trade Center from 9/11. Over 2,600 people were killed at the World Trade Center, 125 at the Pentagon, 87, 60, 59, and 40 were killed on the four airplanes, which doesn't even include the 19 terrorists who also gave their lives, for a total of just under 3,000 people. 3,000 people died as a result of 9/11, and that wasn't even the goal. The goal was what came after. Think about what got put in place after 9/11. Within hours of the attack, all air travel was grounded in our country and into our country for 2 days. 40,000 to 50,000 flights a day canceled for 2 days. Why? Fear. Airport security. If you have flown on a plane since September 11, 2001, you've experienced something like that, or you can relate to that. Look at that line. Look at that equipment. Here are some of the changes that went into place in airport security. Photo ID with a name that matches the ticket is now required. I don't even remember when that wasn't required, but apparently it wasn't at some point. Shoes have to be removed before you go into security checkpoints. No container containing liquid greater than 3.4 ounces can be taken on a plane or taken past security. And only ticketed passengers can get beyond security. You kids don't remember, but we used to go to the gate and greet Grandma when she came to visit us. We took signs and we hugged and we kissed and we said hello. It was great. Now you got to wait outside security or in the car or you meet them at baggage claim. Why? Because of fear. Now every airplane cockpit is locked from the inside so nobody can penetrate and get in. Why? Because of fear. Look at this picture. Look at the difference. That man in blue is actually one of the terrorists who hijacked one of the planes. Look at that security. There's one security guard, and there's a rinky-dink metal detector and one other passenger. Granted, it's 5-something in the morning, but still, why is it different? Why does it look like this now? Because of fear. The Department of Homeland Security was formed. An entire governmental department was formed. Why? Because of fear. The USA Patriot Act was signed into law. Why? Because of fear. I learned what this stands for. This is actually an acronym. It stands for Uniting and Strengthening America, USA, by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. Every law and everything that has to do with the Patriot Act has one job, and that's to stop terrorism. Why? Because of fear. After 9/11, the NSA started monitoring all of our cell phone usage, text messages, emails, social media usage. They don't need a warrant to do that. Why do we allow this? Because of fear. 263 new government organizations were created or reorganized to protect America. Why? Because of fear. And lastly, you can't even go to a football game anymore without having a metal detector scan you and wait in a long line and have your bag checked. Something as simple as going to a football game. Why? Because of fear. Well, what does this have to do with our spiritual walks? What does this have to do with our relationship with God? What does this have to do with our walk with Christ? Well, we talk all the time in here about this battle that we are in, this struggle that we are in, this spiritual battle. Ephesians tells us that we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies. We are not fighting earthly things. We are fighting against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world. We're fighting in an unseen battle against an unseen enemy. We're fighting against mighty powers of this dark world and against evil spirits in heavenly places. Satan, much like the terrorists who do one thing to accomplish another, does the same thing. He'll use any tactic necessary to captivate us with fear, to captivate us and control us by fear. Listen to some of the language that the Bible uses to describe Satan. It says, "Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." If that's not fear language, or language founded in fear, I don't know what is. Satan isn't really a lion. He's like a roaring lion, and he wants to devour you spiritually. Our battle is spiritual. Look what else it says. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Again, language founded in fear. And what does Satan want to steal? What does the enemy want to steal from us? What do we get when we walk with God, when we walk in the Spirit? We get the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, and so on. Satan wants to steal your joy. He wants to steal your peace, your patience, your kindness. He wants to kill you and destroy you spiritually. Our battle is in the spiritual realm. And much like the terrorist who will attack a building to kill people, ultimately to achieve fear, Satan will use any tactic to get you captivated and controlled by fear. This verse here is Jesus talking to some of the Jews, which included some of the Pharisees, and they really just weren't following his teachings. They weren't getting it. And so he says to them, "You belong to your father, the devil." And notice how he describes the devil. He was a murderer from the beginning. A murderer from the beginning. Not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language. For he is a liar and the father of lies. In this spiritual battle, Satan wants to murder you spiritually by speaking his native language of lies. Just like the terrorists, their chief end is to control you and to captivate you with fear. Satan wants to murder you and destroy you by captivating and controlling you by fear. So what is fear? I'm not talking about terror when you watch people falling from a building, which is terrifying. I saw some people look away when I showed those pictures. Last week, Bill told us, fear is the opposite of faith. Fear is anything that works in contrast to faith. God wants us to trust him completely. Anything that works outside of what he says what he says is true is founded in fear. Fear of not believing him at the very least. So what is faith? Hebrews 11 tells us that faith is confidence in what we hope for. You know, hope in the Bible isn't about this doubtful thing that we kind of hope happens. Hope in the Bible is about this thing that we expectantly long for. Eternity with God. Forever communion with him. Seeing Jesus seated at the right hand of his Father in heaven. We hope for that because we expectantly long for it. Not because we doubt that it's going to occur, but because we have confidence it's going to occur. We have assurance about what we do not see. We can't see this. We can experience it. We can feel it. And yet we have an assurance because of Christ. Well, how do we have this faith? How do we live with this faith? How do we go about every single day when the enemy that I've been talking about is attacking us and lying to us, trying to seek, kill, and destroy us and devour us and murder us spiritually? Hebrews 12 tells us that we fix our eyes on him. It's why we always talk about when we meet with people or we disciple others or we have small groups that when we have a problem, we point people to Christ. Because we want people fixing their eyes on Jesus. No matter what is going on. Why? Because he is the author of our faith. What is an author? The person who wrote the story. The person who created it. It originates with him. Christ is the author of our faith. Any measure of faith we have came from him. He wrote that story. Not only that, but as we go through life and we experience things and we turn to him and we fix our eyes on him, he perfects it. He is the perfecter of our faith. We are always in this process of our faith being perfected if we're fixing our eyes on him. There's a great example of this in Matthew. This is the passage where Jesus walks on water. Notice it begins with the word immediately. Well, that means something had just happened. And this is the next thing. Immediately after what had just happened. Well, what had just happened? He fed the 5,000. Y'all know that story? He fed 5,000 people with a few loaves and fishes. It was a great miracle. And immediately after that, it says Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side. He says, all right, guys, I'm done feeding the 5,000. Hop in the boat. Go out on the lake ahead of me. And that ahead of him indicates that they thought he might meet them later. Go on ahead of me. You say that when you're going to see them again soon. Then he dismissed the crowd. He sends the disciples away. He sends the crowd away. And what does he do? After he dismissed them, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone. I don't want y'all to miss that. Jesus, after performing the miracle of feeding the 5,000, and he's about to do the miracle of walking on water, what does he do? He goes and spends the night with God alone. This is vital. This is vital. We need this just like Jesus did. If you do not spend time alone with him, you are missing out on his power. He needed refreshing. He needed wisdom. He needed communion. He needed guidance. It says, the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. So Jesus is up on the mountain praying. The disciples are out on the lake. They're in this boat, and it's being buffeted. Some translations say battered. Some translations say tossed and battered. And some translations say beaten. Regardless of the translation, I think we can understand that this water was rough because the wind was against it. There's a storm brewing here. This is not something that's easy for them. But Jesus sent them out into it. And then we see that Jesus basically spent the whole night praying alone with God. Because it says shortly before dawn. So right before dawn, he decides to go out to them, walking on the lake. Why he chose to do this, I have no idea. But he did. And what do? They see him walking toward them on the lake. And what did they experience? They were terrified. Isn't it interesting that even when we see God, we can be terrified? Satan can use even that to grip us with fear, to terrify us. To me, that's fascinating. They said, it's a ghost. They didn't recognize him. They didn't know what it was. They were so captivated by fear, they didn't even recognize the person they spent virtually every day with, watching him perform miracles, watching him heal people. It's a ghost. And they cried out in fear. Jesus, again, immediately comforts them. Immediately. He didn't let them linger in fear. He revealed himself immediately and said, take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. And this is Peter sitting in the boat. The waves are crashing. The wind is howling. The rain is beating down. The storm is brewing. He recognizes Jesus. But he wants some extra validity. He also wants to see him do a miracle. And he says, Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come to you on the water. I mean, think about that. Don't we oftentimes see or hear God in our lives? And we say, God, is that really you? Give me a sign. If that is really you, do this. If you really want me to do this, then show me this. We do that all the time with things. And what does Jesus say? He just says, come. Peter, the impetuous one. He's always the one who's doing this in the Gospels. He says, show me, tell me to come. And Jesus says, come. And this is where I want to camp out for just a minute. I want you guys to picture yourself in this boat as one of the disciples. Storm is raging. Winds are blowing. Waves are crashing. It's scary. It's terrifying. Life is beating you down. Satan is working to captivate you with fear. Think of this boat as a metaphor for something you're going through right now. Whatever that may be. Something that you believe God has said something to you. That he wants you to come to him. That you see him out on the water. And you say, God, if that's really what you want, show me. Show me. Tell me to come. Maybe it's a relationship that's been severed or broken or greatly harmed, and something in you is telling you to go to that person and seek forgiveness, to humble yourself and be reconciled to them. You see Jesus out there, and he's saying, go to that person. Come to me. Come to me out on this water and be reconciled. Maybe it's forgiveness. Maybe there's some deep hurt that you've got from long ago or even last week. And you know God has commanded you to forgive. Bill just spent weeks talking about it. Maybe during that time he's brought something to mind and you've seen Jesus out on the water and he said, come and forgive this person. Let this go finally after all this time. Maybe it's your marriage. Maybe your marriage is rocky. Maybe your relationship is difficult. Maybe your spouse is not easy to love. And God is saying, I hate divorce. Fight for this. It is worth it. Love this person even though they don't deserve it. And you see Jesus out on the water and he's saying, come, do this. Be obedient to me. Trust me. Don't look at the waves. Don't hear the crashing. Don't feel the wind. Come. Maybe you have a wayward child or a child that's in rebellion and you're at a loss and you don't know what to do. And maybe God is saying, I got this. Let this go. Trust me. Come. Maybe it's an illness. Maybe you've been diagnosed with a terminal illness, or maybe you're fearful of being diagnosed with one. And God is saying, trust me. Come. You see him out on the water. He's walking on water. And you hear his voice, and he says, come. Maybe it's an addiction. Maybe it's a stronghold that you've had for years, that you battle every single day, and you have felt God, and you have heard him say, lay this down at the altar. You see Christ out on the water, and he's telling you, lay this down. Come to me. Maybe it's a job situation. Maybe you've been laid off and you're out of work. You don't know what's next. Your family is scared. And God says, come to me. Give this to me. Trust me. And yet Satan is saying, you're not going to be able to pay your house payment. He's trying to captivate you with fear, control you with fear. And Jesus is out on the water saying, come. Or maybe it's that person at work or that family member who doesn't know Christ, and you've been feeling that urge to share your faith with them, and yet you've been terrified to do so. Fear of rejection, fear of what they're going to say, who knows what. But Jesus is saying, come to me. He's out there on the water. Come to me. No matter what it is, it doesn't matter what it is. He's out there on the water. And he's saying, come. And we do that by fixing our eyes on Jesus. He is the author of our faith. He is the perfecter of our faith. No matter what it is, if God has put that on your heart and you are fixing your eyes on him, he will perfect it. Satan's lying, just like the terrorists attacking a building to captivate a world in fear. Satan is lying to captivate you with fear, trying to take your eyes off of Jesus and put it on the storm. And he says, come. But you have to step out of the boat. You have to step out of the boat. It says, got down out of the boat. He could have camped out right there in the boat. He could have said, no, the waves are crashing. The wind is blowing. You come to me. Come to me. I'm good here in the boat. But he didn't. He got down out of the boat. And what did he do? He walked on water. And he came toward Jesus. But like what happens when he saw the wind, when he started paying attention to what Satan was doing, the lies that he was telling in his native language, the seeking and the killing and the destroying that Satan was trying to do, he took his eyes. He stopped fixing his eyes on Jesus. And what happened? He was afraid. And he began to sink. And so what did he do? Like we always do. He cried out, Lord, save me. Lord, save me. And what did Jesus do? Again, immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. Jesus grabbed him immediately. But he had taken his eyes and he said, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? I told you to come. I'm walking on water. You were walking on water. I was doing a miracle in your life. And Jesus pulled him up into the boat, and the wind died down. And the other disciples did what? They worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. My friends, whatever it is that God puts on your heart, that he truly reveals to you, that you believe he has spoken to you, I don't know what it is. He's out there on the water, and he's saying, come. But you have to step out of the boat. You can't walk on water inside the boat. Satan will. He will lie to you, and he will try to get your eyes on the waves, or the thing, or life, or the circumstances, whatever he can do to captivate you and control you with fear, which is no more than the opposite of faith.